Welcome, everybody, to the Renegade HPG podcast. This is Travis, and my guest today is Christopher Wales. Chris is a veteran, gamer, hobbyist, and streamer, and you can find him painting and chatting up his audience several nights each week on Twitch. That channel is Thunderhead Studio and is also a source of some of the coolest cityscapes you can find in our hobby, which Chris sells through Steel Warrior Studios, and you can also find through this channel's sponsor, Fortress Miniatures and Games. I'm looking forward to chatting up Chris tonight and glad you guys can join us for the fun. Chris, welcome to the cast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. I found you in my own novice painting days. I think it was it earlier this year? Maybe it was even late last year. But for me, those kind of short videos, which is kind of the tips and tricks along the way, they just don't do it for me. I like watching somebody go along and kind of do it. And so I found your Twitch stream and really enjoyed it, especially enjoyed kind of the shout outs you give at the end. And I remember, you know, at least one or two nights sitting there with my girlfriend being like waiting there for like 30 minutes. I was like, he's gonna look at my mini. He's going to talk about my mini. And so, you know, don't underestimate, you know, how much a novice painter kind of enjoys that little bit of recognition. But, I'm curious how you got into Twitch, kind of what made you kind of settle into that platform and kind of choose that as kind of your medium for sharing with the community.
Well, prior to 2019, if I'm being honest, I was aware that Twitch was a thing, that mm-hmm. it existed, that people went on the internet and they played games. This is the portion of it that I was familiar with. Yeah. But then the part I wasn't familiar with was that they pointed cameras at themselves and other people would watch them play games and they'd be like, "Hey monkey, dance for my amusement. Here's $2. And they would do their little dance. And I was like, why would anyone do this? This seems insane. But in late 2019, the early part of 2020, when many of us were kind of looking around going, "Whew, man, I'm glad I've got hobbies right now." Yeah. A friend of mine I caught on Twitch, he goes by the Daylight Gamer, and he's more of your traditional sort of variety gaming streamer. And he and I have been friends for 20 some odd years. We both went military, different branches, kind of went off, did our thing, came back together. We've been, you know, in contact that whole time. I started watching him. And as I was watching him play games, I started clicking on other channels. And I was like, wait a second, people are painting minis. Like, the people are doing more than just playing games. What the hell's going on here? And that just sort of snowballed. And I thought this could be fun. I had recently, at the time, moved rural. I used to live in San Antonio, Texas, a fairly populous area with a really good gaming scene. Mm-hmm. And post-Army, with more time on my hands, I had found myself becoming like the comic book store guy from The Simpsons. I just sort of hang around the FLGS and be like, "Oh no, you don't want to buy those Space Marines. You want to buy these Space Marines." And people go like, "Oh, that's really nice, man. Yeah, thanks. Maybe stand 5 feet further away from me." But I'd hang out down there and I was friends with the owner and we'd play games and organize events. And that all went away when I moved. And it's much harder for me to get into game stores. So I was like, you know, I just kind of want to hang out and nonsense about games and talk about painting minis and show off stuff that I've painted and see stuff that just everything that I used to do at the game store. Yeah. So I thought, why the hell couldn't I do that on Twitch? And I got a camera and I started doing it. And roughly 2 years later, here I am with a surprisingly active Twitch channel. And I'm really very gratified to hear you mention that we do that art share segment at the end of every one of my streams called the Storm Report, where people can post pictures and we do sort of a review, and you can be like, "Oh, I did this and I'm really proud of it. Here, look at it." Or you can say like, "I'm not really sure where to go with this. What color would you use for this part?" And I always just try to give what feedback I can. I don't pretend to be an expert. I'm no, you know, there are painters out there on Instagram that just make us all look like we have broken fingers. Yeah. But I just know that was very helpful to me early on, was getting even simple feedback. Because posting your pictures to things like Reddit, even, you know, Instagram, Twitter, stuff like that, like, people will see it. How many people are going to say anything about it? Yeah. It's so hard to get engagement any of those places. I think I saw somebody recently on one of those posts like, "Oh, post your picture. What's the worst thing that can happen? Someone's going to downvote you." And I'm like, no, the worst thing that can happen is literally no one will say anything at all.
Totally.
That's 99% of the time. That's what happens. And that sucks. So for, you know, a little bit of time, 3 times a week, I will say things about what you painted. And I have found that that has helped a lot of people just continue with the hobby. And that to me is immensely important, because it's just practice. It's just work, and keeping that enthusiasm up without any infusion of outside input is very hard to do. And we've all been so isolated for the last 2 years.
Totally.
So
yeah, that was kind of what I needed kind of early on. And I just kind of find, even in my groups, I have, you know, I had a gaming friend who was professional painter for Hasbro. You know, he painted kind of most of Vincent's collection, you know.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Back in the day, you know, he's the one that kind of did all those paint schemes. And I had another one who does like paint classes, you know, and I was just like, hey, can you, you know, help me out? And it's like, too busy or just like not interested, you know, in kind of the one-on-one, because everybody asks him, I'm sure. And so for me, and I had taken a painting class in the local, you know, local game store, and it was just, it wasn't super helpful. It was just above my head. And for me, what I really want, you know, learning wise, is just kind of one-on-one. Let me kind of sit next to a painter. Let us both like pick a scheme that we like. And then me just kind of follow along and ask questions as I go. And kind of, you know, your stream was the closest that I could find to that. Where
kind
I could
of very, at least... very personal, very tactile.
Exactly. And that's how I learned. And, you know, recently I had connected with Oliver over in Germany, who I asked him to put together a, you know, basically just record his painting. You know, I asked him to do what I wanted, you know, for a paint scheme that I really loved. And I posted that on the channel. Hopefully it, you know, helps some people with that. But it was kind of, you know, I don't need all the nice cuts. You know, you look at Duncan out there, he's, you know, wonderful painter. Now he's getting into BattleTech, which is great, but you know, are you kidding? You know, in 20 minutes, you're going to show me how to do everything that you do. It's just, I think that people who are
also sleek and so edited.
I know. And
sometimes you get that, you know, draw the rest of the owl effect a lot of the times is what I get from those. It's like, okay, make a circle. Now do a lot, underline this here. Okay, now just paint the rest of the mini. Like, okay.
So I'm just like, well, how do you get the paint to not dry on your brush after 5 seconds? You know, how do I mix this with the thing? You know, what air pressure do I put on my, you know, airbrush, you know, compressor? It's just like the things that they don't even think about, because it's natural. And I'm just like, I don't know what I'm doing, and it's all important. And so, you know, that was, it was definitely kind of appreciated, you know, your channel is the only one I've ever watched on Twitch. I downloaded Twitch to watch your stuff, and that's the only stuff I've done. There are two platforms that that are beyond my experience. One is Twitch and one is Discord. And so from the Twitch side, you know, kind of as the veteran there, can you explain that platform and kind of how to use it and how it works in terms of signing up for channels and supporting people for kind of like a, you know, green behind the ears, you know, novice like me?
It's an interesting place, Twitch. Yeah. And I'd be lying if I said I was any sort of an expert in it. I have made it work for me over the last 2 years, and I've certainly learned a lot about it. I'll tell you, first of all, what you just said, as you opened that I'm the only person, I'm the only channel that you watch on Twitch, that is music to the ears of the Twitch streamer. Yeah. Because engagement on Twitch, you're a content creator, so many of these concepts cross over very easily, but you know, getting that engagement with your content is always the trick. Whether you're creating YouTube videos where discoverability is super, super high, creating content for like TikTok, which is a platform that I have no understanding of at all. Yeah. I'm watching other Twitch painters do like little TikTok videos, and like Walter's Workshop does those, and I'm just like, I feel so old. What is this?
I'm just figuring out Facebook, and now Facebook is for old people. Wait, I'm old.
I just got Instagram figured out. Yeah, I just got Instagram figured out. And then they're like, make a 7-second video. Oh no, no. Yeah. But it's like most other social media platforms. It's just a little weird at first because you're not used to all the nomenclature. Mm-hmm. It's pretty straightforward insofar as just you register on it. You say, hey, I want to stream. You get yourself a piece of OBS software, which just interfaces all your hardware with their servers. And then, boop, you stream, and you can stream whatever you want to Twitch. There are people who stream.
Let me stop you. I'll step back. how, like, as a viewer, how do you kind of use Twitch as a platform? Not necessarily, you know, as
it's
a
tricky.
Creator. Yeah.
It's tricky. That's the best thing you can do is just go on to Twitch and start clicking around, honestly. And this is one of my complaints about Twitch as a platform. Like I said, the engagement is difficult and the discoverability is very low. The best way you can really find a Twitch streamer is by looking on platforms other than Twitch. Find somebody you like on Instagram, check their links. If they've got a Twitch link, click over to their channel. Once you've started watching someone, Twitch will start recommending people to you that have similar content or that other viewers also watch in addition to that person. Also, as far as sort of the culture on Twitch goes, when another streamer comes into a streamer's chat and they're sort of friendly, because there's lots of networking between Twitch streamers, they'll usually do what's called a shout out, which is just there'll be a little to be like, oh, Walter's Workshop. I keep mentioning him. He's a friend of mine on Twitch. Like, oh, he's in chat. He just said, hi, let's get a shout out for Walter's Workshop real quick. And you'll see the link pop up in chat. We'll usually go back and forth a little bit. And I'll usually, when I'm in a stream that I like and they get a shout out, I'll click over and I'll drop them a follow. So you follow your streamers. And then when they go online, Twitch will send you a notification, such and such is going online. Mostly that's handled again through other social media, though. Discord is a very, very popular one. Most streamers have their own Discord servers. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, people will post when they're going on. Like I said, it's a weird beast. I feel like, because Amazon owns Twitch, and I'm really hoping in the next few years they integrate better discoverability features. Because like I said, right now, your best chance to find good Twitch streamers is almost any place other than Twitch and then clicking over to their Twitch profile.
Well, people listening know now, download Twitch, find Thunderhead Studio, follow.
There you go.
And then let the rest take care of itself there.
Yeah. In fact, I should say, but technically, the best way you can use Twitch is to go on Twitch and find the channel called Thunderhead Studio and give it a follow and listen to everything that he says. And when he pitches his merch, go buy mugs that say Thunderhead Studio. Okay. I can't keep that up. I know. Yeah.
So let's go to Discord then, because Discord is even like, it's like a foreign language to me, and you know, everybody seems to use it and I cannot navigate it to save my life. You know, it's the only thing I'm connected to everything Battletech, which I really just kind of use to drop a little note about what I'm doing.
That with server is so dense. That server is okay. Is it just dense.
That one? Okay, maybe, you know, so, and there's a Battletech CCG group, you know, that I'm in, but you know, the CCG is pretty quiet there. Most of the activity is on Facebook for that game. It's just even finding things, it's weird. You know, so what are your tips for Discord novices? Because again, apparently I'm old. I guess 41 is old now. I don't feel
Discord
old,
but, is it's an interesting beast. It's actually an older one. Mm-hmm. It didn't used to look like it does now. It got started back in the days of like TeamSpeak, when it was people just needed easily accessed voice servers for playing multiplayer games. That's sort of where Discord got its start. Okay. It was just you'd make a group and you'd send a link to your friends and they'd all get in your group and then you could all voice chat at the same time in whatever game you were playing. You're playing World of Warcraft, you're playing, you know, other also multiplayer games. Clearly I'm an expert on those. But that's another funny one in that you're not going to find it. Like if you just download Discord and open it up, you're not going to find much, because that's not how it works. It is very much like a lot of other social media, but think of it more as like a series of Facebooks, but each individual one, each social media platform within it only has in it the people that you want in it. So what you can do is register a server and then you can make links or you can invite people and other people join that server. And then within that server, there are channels and you can share video, you can share voice clips, you can share pictures, you can chat, but it's all within the context of that individual server. So I, for instance, have the Thunderhead Studio Discord. And then within that Discord, there's like a general channel. There's a memes channel. There's a Battletech section. There's a wargaming terrain section. You can go to those topics and kind of have conversations with one another. And it's a bit like the Wild West in that each server is run differently and each server will be run in accordance with how the server owner wants it to be run. They'll have their own rules. They'll have their own standards. They'll usually have their own like moderation team, depending on how large it is. I can say that I'm also a member of Everything Battletech. That server is well, first of all, it's huge. And I find somewhat humorously that the larger a Discord server is, the less useful it often is. For getting things like big announcements out, or for like following your favorite artist or following your favorite company, it can be very useful for that when it's really, really big. But there's a threshold you hit where it's hard to even get noticed. And yeah, that one in particular has like what I call channel glut. If you go into it, there's just all these channels on the left-hand side and you're like, what do I do? Where do I start? Which of these channels do I want to be in? And they're all so granular and so specific that it's really, really daunting. And I can say that as someone who runs a Discord server that is relatively popular at this point, I think we've got like 500 members. I do everything in my power to control that channel glut, because it's tempting when you're running a server. You're like, oh, people over here, they've started playing Star Wars Squadrons. So we should have a channel for talking about Star Wars Squadrons. But if you do that every single time a game pops up, now you've just like, there's a, you know, 20 channels there that people are going to look at, and they're just going to go cross-eyed and they're going to leave your server. Yeah. So it's a balance, but every single Discord server you're in is going to be run, again, according to how the owner wants it to be run. And that's very similar to Twitch, in that the best place to find Discord servers are on the broader social medias of the topics that you're looking for. Like if you go to my Facebook or my Instagram, you'll find links to my Twitch and my Discord, but you usually have to, people send you server links, but you don't just go into Discord and browse. I mean, you can.
Yeah.
You can go into Discord and just browse based on keywords and stuff. I don't think I ever have.
Well, I think that was my error, because I was just trying to you know, make it a different form of, you know, Facebook or Twitter or whatnot. And, you know, it seems like it's basically it's a virtual, you know, local play group, you know, and so, you know,
it certainly can be.
And once you're on, you know, you're kind of in that group, but it's,
in fact, I've got servers in my list. I'm in a lot of different servers for different reasons. Mm-hmm. There are servers that are literally nothing but me and six other people who like to game a lot. So we've got our own little server, and you'll just go in there and be like, hey, buttheads, who wants to play?
Yeah.
And you can ping people, you can assign roles, you can assign tags, you can group people by those tags and then ping people according to those tags. So if you've got some players that play this game, some players that play game B, you can just ping game B, and people with that interest will see it. And like, it can get really in depth as far as running and organizing, but as far as using, it can be pretty intuitive as long as you find the right server.
Gotcha. So where's the name come from, Thunderhead Studio?
Oh, that's a fun story. That is the name of the property that I live on, Thunderhead Ranch, which was named by my grandfather when he purchased it shortly after returning from World War II. He was in the U.S. Army Air Corps. He was an officer, and he was, I believe, radio crew on it'd be easy for me to pick a designation out of the air, but I can't remember what type of bomber it was he was on. He was on a large strategic bomber, though. And they had scrawled on the side of that old girl, Thunderhead. That was their name. And he came back here and he purchased this land and started a family and named it Thunderhead Ranch. And it was appropriate because we get a lot of them on top of that. Thunderheads, that is. Lots and lots of weather out here. And the logo is tied in with that, because that was actually the brand that he registered for the when he bought the place. Now it's very, very tricky these days. If you're going to start up like a ranch, you have to register your brand, and the brand has to conform to certain rules. It's, you know, letters with small bits of stylizing that you can do on them. Mm-hmm. If you were to go out right now and try to register a brand and make it a single letter, it's virtually impossible in the United States. It's just a matter of like, those have already been taken.
Right.
But he got in there early and he got that single R, and he stylized it with the little arrow on the bottom leg, which is the meteorological symbol for a Thunderhead. It's an anvil. It's really basically my grandfather's legacy. And I never knew him. I never had the opportunity to. He unfortunately passed before I was born. So after I kind of moved out here and took up stewardship of the place, I just sort of adopted that as an online moniker. And it's just sort of rolled from there. And to this day, I really I feel like I can seem like a bit of a bit marketing obsessed mm-hmm. at times. You'll notice I'm putting my brand on just everything. I'm like, I put it on my paint handle. I put it on my pictures. I put it on my t-shirts. I put it on freaking everything. And honestly, like I like doing it just because it makes me feel closer to them. Yeah. It makes me feel this little connection to someone that I never knew. And we shared the same name. We were both in the Army and we were never in the same room together. But we both got Thunderhead, you know?
It's a good story. What happens on the ranch these days? Is it just your streaming or is there other stuff going on out there?
Well, we're looking this next year in the spring to get some chickens going. The land sat kind of not quite derelict, but very nearly for almost 15 to 20 years.
Gotcha.
Not a lot happened out here. So we moved out just about 3 years ago. And in that 3 years, I have mostly just been recovering. There has been a lot of work to do. Like I said, it fell into disrepair. People started dumping trash on it. Some old buildings collapsed. Some roofs collapsed. Like it was a matter of figuring out what could be salvaged and throwing away what couldn't. And I had to pull up some 50 old like posts from the pasture and the back of the property. And like it has just been just destruction and garbage. But we're finally just now at a point where I'm like, I have thrown away the last of the trash. There are no more collapsed structures. Everything is relatively sound. Everything's been freshly painted and I can start building again. I can start really making things happen out here. So we're going to get some chickens in the spring is the plan. I've got a large workshop building. I'm slowly kind of refurbishing the inside of. I'm going to put some insulation out there. I'd like to get more of a 3D print shop going out there. It's lots of little stuff.
Awesome.
And
well, I think it makes a difference because you know when you're creating content like this, it's kind of hard. It's hard working sometimes that there's not an end to it. You know, there's a difference between jobs that you just like keep going and jobs, you know, like, you know, building a fence, you know, you know,
yeah,
setting up
a
chicken run where it's like you do it, you know, it's done, and you can kind of sit back and enjoy it. Whereas, you know, with the content, it's like you hit publish on a video every once in a while, but there's still just something else, something more. So it's a good balance, I'm sure. But talking about that 3D printing, you know, tell me a little bit about kind of what you guys are doing there, because, you know, you've made some really awesome cityscapes, you know, for people to kind of enhance that tabletop experience. You know, tell me about that. You know, are you designing it? How are you guys selling it? You know, what that's been like?
So that has been an interesting process. 3D printing is, I want to say, relatively new acquisition for me, but I think I got into it about the same time there was a big push in general when the Ender 3 became really, really popular and started selling like hotcakes. I kind of got in around then. About 2.5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And I got back into BattleTech at around the same time as everybody else did when CGL picked it up. I've been playing BattleTech since I was a little kid. I can still remember using paper standees with my brothers on the dining room table, you know, and then playing, you know, MechWarrior 3, MechWarrior 4. And obviously I was big into HBS BattleTech when that really, I mean, obviously it's more recently, but who doesn't love that game? That game's amazing. And CGL comes out with these new minis and I'm just tickled. They really have done a fantastic job with them, and this huge resurgence of interest in BattleTech. And it all coincided with, I have a 3D printer. I'm getting back into this. A lot of people are 3D printing stuff for the game. And I got a game room where I can actually store lots of my stuff now, which I didn't have where I lived before. So I'm like, I love wargaming terrain. I love it. I'm, you know, we spend so much time on these hobbies. We spend more time painting and fooling with them than we do playing with them a lot of the time. Totally. And I'll be the first to admit that I treat them like toys. I like having my little dioramas and my setups, and I like the visuals, and I, you know, it just fires my imagination. And I got some of the CGL maps and I was looking at them and I was just thinking, I just wish it was in 3D. So I picked up a 3D design piece of software and I made some hexes and I extruded them to a certain height and I printed them out. And I was like, hey, what do you know? That works. And then I got the ones that they have with the raised base on it. And I was like, I could make these buildings. That's a cool idea. I could do that for myself, right? I've got the time. I have the means. We have the technology. So I made those and printed some buildings and started posting them around. Like, hey, look at this thing that I made. Isn't this kind of cool? I genuinely never intended to get into selling terrain. I was just making it so that myself and my wife could play some cool games out in the game room. And Steel Warrior Studios contacted me one day and said, hey, a friend of mine showed me your stuff and wanted me to print some of it for him. How do you feel about me selling your stuff? I was like, okay, sure, let's do that. And that has just been a snowball rolling downhill since. And the community response to it has honestly been just absolutely flabbergasting. I have maintained, though, my design philosophy from the very beginning is I make things because I want them. Yeah. And should you happen to like them and also want them, they are also available. Right. But it can be sometimes why my releases are a little random and not always what people are asking for. Because I get passionate about something because I want it on my table, so I go and I make it. And as it happens, I really wanted a whole lot of urban terrain. And I wanted it to fit inside of hexes because I love classic Battletech. I'm not much of an Alpha Strike player. Okay. I wanted it to be playable. I wanted to be able to stand in every hex while also having every hex clearly delineated. And I confess, I looked around first. It was the first thing I did because I wasn't designing much yet, little stuff here and there. I said, who else is making this stuff? What can I use to fit within these parameters? And the answer was virtually nothing. So I looked at, like, you know, Hardware Studios. Oh my God, Dale over there makes such great stuff.
Yeah,
he has dialed in his aesthetic so beautifully. But I looked at him like, it's not quite what I want. Maybe I could make something. And Trinity City was sort of born from that. And I make files and I send them off to Steel Warrior Studios, who's Canadian based. And he hosts the files for sale so that you can go to his website, you can buy the STLs and you can print them yourself. And I made it very clear to him early on that I didn't want to just like pump and dump anybody on any of these files, which is why if you purchase anything from him, if I do a version 2, version 3, whatever update, which I do very regularly when I learn new things, when I find old problems that I didn't know existed before, and he goes out and, okay, here's the new line of files. You can come download them. So anytime you buy anything from him, you're going to get every iteration after that as part of that purchase. And I expected that to be the bulk of the money that I made through him, because I was thinking if we could just make this worthwhile, just a little bit of money, it gives me more time to design, you know?
Yeah.
People buy physical prints though, like crazy. I didn't think they would. I thought people are going to get 3D printers and they're just going to buy the files and it's going to be real cool, kind of this open source thing. And he just moves so much plastic though. I'm consistently amazed at it and just floored and incredibly flattered by it. He's running a facility with, I think, 88 operational printers right now. Awesome. And he's upgrading to 100 shortly, and he's just keeping them running just constantly. He has an employee now who helps him with maintenance. Like, it's kind of like a real business, which
sounds like
it's all been very organic and very unexpected. And yeah, it's largely been because the Battletech community is as supportive and as enthusiastic as it is.
Well, I mean, certainly speaking for myself, you know, I only have a limited amount of time to kind of invest in my hobby, you know, and, you know, if I love something that's 3D printed and it looks beautiful, it doesn't mean I want to go out and buy a 3D printer and learn how to use the 3D printer and, you know, how
it is like its own hobby.
Bad prints, you know, and so yeah. I want to just focus on playing Battletech, you know, and so it's nice to have that opportunity to go out and just buy it. So I understand. I understand that need of the community. I mean, it's great to hear you talk about kind of what you're focused on, because I think that's what people should do in their business. You know, you focus on what you want. When you're trying to chase the market, I think that's a mistake, because the market's always changing. And one, hopefully the market's big enough that there's always going to be somebody that's interested in something. And if you're always chasing something that you think people want, you could be wrong and you're not going to be having fun doing it. But if you're always doing something you like, then when people find it and they like it too, that's a bonus, you know, because you've already enjoyed the process.
There are designers out there. I'm not going to... name no names and cast no aspersions, because they're very, very talented with the tools that they use, but in many cases, much more talented at creating 3D files than I am. I continue to grow. I continue to learn. I continue to expand my tool set. But some of these people are like, I've been doing 3D design for 20 years. I'm like, oh shit. Okay. But there are designers out there who I swear what they do is they sit by like Twitter monitoring the popular hashtags of the week. Whatever that is, they make a 3D file and they put it up for sale within 48 hours. And oh my God, do they make money? Yeah. Oh my God, it's just hand over fist. And I'll tell you, there have been a few times since I started doing this as like a job, which it kind of has become. Mm-hmm. I've thought about it. You know, you have those thoughts. You ask yourself, like, what am I doing this for? How much money do I want to make? Is this really a business? Is this just a hobby? Like, you have to define that for yourself. I'm very, very lucky in that I don't necessarily need to do this to live. I have other sources of income, but I still have enough time to work on this. Mm-hmm. But you know, making some money on it justifies the amount of time that I spend on it. But again, I find myself asking, like, should I do that? Should I just make what's popular? Not necessarily what I want, but what other people want. And I'll say there's even been a time or two where I've tried to do that. Been like, well, this seems popular. This is what people want. It doesn't really excite me. That isn't necessarily what matters. Let's try doing it. And you know what happens is I just stare at the screen, just kind of listlessly dragging my mouse back and forth, occasionally adding a detail here or there. And then I play some XCOM 2 for a while. Like I realized very quickly, like, that's not going to work. That's not what I'm here to do. I work best when I am excited. When I see something and I go, this is cool, I want to do this.
Yeah.
And I just ride that wave as long as I can.
Well, I had the same experience with on my channel when it was still relatively small, you know, probably around 1,000 subscribers or so. I did it with the unboxing. And so I started to get some of my Catalyst Wave 1 stuff. And I was like, oh, this is cool. I see people doing like unboxing videos, which I'm not a huge fan of. You're watching people open things, but people kept asking, like, how do they compare? You know, and I was curious too, like, how do these minis compare to the old ones? And so I made unboxing videos where I compared it to the old, every old version of it, you know, metal version or plastic version, whatever Iron Winds or our Fast that I had put out previously. You know, and then I did it for the Urban Mech first and it exploded. It was getting way more views than almost
the Urban Mech is such a meme right now too.
It is too. And I was like, this is great. I'll do it for Lance Pack. And I did it with the Lance Pack and I did it for one more. And then it had gotten to, I was like, I'm an unboxer. I don't want to film on opening things. That's just not my jam, you know? And so I had kind of the enthusiasm of comparing it to the old scale had waned, you know, once you do 10 of them, you pretty much get an idea of how the new plastics compare to the old size. And, so I was like, yeah, we're not going to do this anymore. Even though, you know, they were, I think, the most viewed, you know, videos on the channel at the time, other than maybe like my Mike Stackpole podcast. But fortunately, once Tex was generous enough to hop on for the podcast, that certainly helped bring attention to it. So I didn't have to worry about unboxing videos to bring attention. But yes, talking about 3D printing, I'm kind of curious if you can kind of guide us through as someone who works in this. People in the community don't know what they can do, what they can do. You know, what are kind of the guidelines? You know, what do you need to buy? What do you need to make for yourself? You know, what can be sold? What can't be sold? What can be given away as gifts? You know, what are those lines for people who aren't familiar that respect the rules but don't know the rules?
So as far as, and I know this is a lot of what concerns people with 3D printing uniquely within the world of wargaming. Mm-hmm. Because 3D printing as a technology is a very, very broad topic, and it is a very exciting topic. And within that topic, the limitations are the bounds of your imagination, honestly. It is still a relatively young technology that has seen a massive boom in the last few years. And to sum up my thoughts on that broadly, it's the future of the hobby. I really believe that it is. It's only going to become more accessible over the coming years. And there will be a point in the near future where everyone right now who's, do I want to get one? Do I want to maintain one? There will be a model for you. I don't know what it is yet. I don't know who's going to make it. There will be a model for you. So I would advise people to just, you know, maybe just keep your finger on the pulse a little bit. But as the big question for tabletop gaming, and this is the question that everybody's asking, BattleTech, Warhammer 40K, you know, anything from Mantic Games, Star Wars Legion, like all of these games, people are asking, what are the boundaries of intellectual property rights? And the truth is, right now, it's kind of the Wild West. There are a lot of common licenses out there that people use that are legally enforceable, and you'll see a lot of them on Thingiverse, but that comes with a big asterisk of legally enforceable, providing you have the time and money to attempt said enforcement. It's one thing to say you're violating my license, and it's another thing to get a lawyer and file a claim. And the vast majority of people aren't, like, it's a question of how much is it worth it a lot of the time. Now, that is obviously different when we're talking about IP that's owned by big companies. There was the big strike a while back by, I think we determined ultimately it was the Topps Corporation.
Right.
Yeah, that did the great BattleTech purge on Thingiverse. And every time something like that happens, there's this huge uproar. Oh, the Topps is evil. CGL is evil. How dare they do this to us, the hardworking salt of the earth 3D sculptors who didn't design any of these things. It's IP holders have to protect their copyrights. They have to protect their copyrights, because if they don't actively pursue the protection of their copyright, they will legally lose the ability to protect said copyrights. So people did the same thing with, we've just had this big influx of players from Warhammer 40K, because they changed their policies on YouTube videos. And that was another one where it's like, they're making money. Like, they've gotta, if they don't move to protect this, they're soon going to find that they can't anymore, and that their IP is just sort of open source to anybody on the internet who wants to make a bunch of videos and run their own Space Marine show.
Well, they'll start making rule books instead of miniatures, because everyone will have the miniatures and they don't want to be a rule book company, you know.
So. And it's questionable. I personally, and this is the sort of thing that a lot of us have to decide for ourselves, is where we fall on what we're comfortable calling piracy or not piracy. There's some things that obviously are. I think that a lot of the Etsy sellers who do 3D printed mechs are, well, let's just say there's a lot of my stuff that I've made that I intended to be distributed for free that some randos on Etsy are making money printing and distributing. And I'll tell you, it peeves me.
Yeah.
It peeves me real good. I don't like it. And I can only imagine how other creators feel. I know Ion Raptor is he's designed a lot of mechs for 3D printing. He pulled all of his stuff from general distribution, because Etsy sellers just pick up the file and they start selling it. And then it's on guys like me to, do I want to actually file like a DMCA? Do I want to actually get a lawyer? Who do I contact? Is Etsy going to do anything? And at the end of the day, it's easier for us just not to make our stuff available.
Yeah.
So it's a lot about community, is kind of what I'm trying to come back around to. And BattleTech has had fewer problems with it than many others. I'm going to keep coming back around to the fact that BattleTech has a pretty fantastic online community. All things said, we keep an eye on a couple of groups whose sole purpose is spreading pirated content. People will buy STLs and then distribute them there for people who have not purchased them. And I have been very, very lucky and very grateful to note that the few times people have gone on there and said, hey, anybody got Thunderhead Studios stuff? Anybody got that Trinity City you could send me? People will smack them down a lot of the time. It's like, no, just go buy it. We don't charge a lot for it, and we make a lot of stuff available freely. But like I said, it's kind of the Wild West, and you kind of have to figure it out for yourself a lot of the time. If it feels sleazy, it probably is.
Yeah.
And well, there are people out there.
If they're selling under the BattleTech name,
you can't do that.
If someone's selling you a Mad Cat, you shouldn't be buying it.
No.
Unless it's
wrong. No.
If someone's selling you, a mech, or miscellaneous mecha, and it looks like what you want, then at least they're recognizing the fact that they can't market under an established IP. For me, we had done a you know, a sculpt for the Archer, you know, for Gallery 3025 and Renegade HVG. And I, cause I don't like the new Archer. I think I just don't like the look of it, you know? And so I was like, and I like the old Spartan design. And so I was like completely ignore MechWarrior Online, completely ignore CGL. Let's just basically redo the Spartan. And it came up with a beautiful, you know, new version of the Archer, which is now my favorite version of the Archer, you know? And so I want to try to get, I reached out to Alan Blackwell. He was kind of a little iffy on whether he should, you know, turn it into a 3D for me. So I'll reach out to Dale next and see if he'll do it. And then I'll reach out to Lauren, cause I don't want to like ruffle his feathers, and I'll say, you know, hey Lauren, this is what I want to do. I want to print these up and basically give them as a thank you to people that support my channel. Is that cool with you? You know, and is it cool, you know, if we sell them under, you know, Mecha and Fortress Miniatures Games, you know, I'll call it like Leonidas or something to have a little bit of a, you know, tied to the Spartan namesake. But yeah, so
try well, to and you hit on an important point there as far as people who aren't sure what the rules are for a particular file. Try as hard as you can to find the person who made the file in the first place. Try to track it down, which you usually can if you're getting things through sites like Thingiverse or Cults 3D. Try to find the creator and just ask. Honestly, just ask. Most of the time, if you're on something like Thingiverse, you can go and look at the licensing and it'll say things like, you know, no derivatives, non-commercial, which basically means you can't change this file and redistribute it and you can't make any money off of it, but anything else is kosher. I would say broadly, if you're giving things away, most people aren't going to complain. That feels like that's right up there with the right to sell or give away essentially anything that you just happen to own anyway, or more give away, less than sell. It would never bother me if someone was like, hey, come watch my video. We're going to have a giveaway. We're going to give away some of Thunderhead Shadowhawks. They'd be like, yeah, go for it. I don't care. Yeah. But if somebody's selling something for profit, like who is it? Like Polygon Masterworks does a lot of his own. He does all of his own files. And he has a Patreon. Trying to think of like Strato Minis, who has his own line of, I think they call them retro hard bots, which we all know what they are. You look at them and you're like, oh, it's the shade chicken. Oh yeah. Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
It's the fire falcon. Gee, I wonder what that could be.
You know, yeah.
Definitely. Like we all know what they are, but he's done his own designs of them. They're his files that he has made from the ground up, and he is selling them. He is making money off of them. He is pulling a profit off of them. Don't distribute those. And if you find someone distributing them, go let them know. Hey, man, somebody's giving away your stuff.
Yeah.
It requires a certain amount of community policing. It requires all of us to try and think ethically as much as we can. I think that eventually some more advanced forms of enforcement are going to pop up. I don't know what they're going to be yet. But we're all sort of figuring it out as a group right now. So I would just tell everybody, try to think ethically and be a part of the solution as much as you can. It's the old, you know, go out there and create the good that you want to see in the world. Or in other words, please don't steal shit.
Yeah. You know, or at least credit people when you're using it. And even, at if, least they're, credit even people. If they're giving it away, you know, at least reach out, say, hey, I really like
when in doubt, ask.
Can I use it?
Yeah. Yeah. The worst thing someone could do is say no, and then you go do something else.
You know, or say, hey, send me $5 or $10, you know, to cover what it would cost, and which we're cool. And you can
generally people are very happy with that.
Yeah. So it's easy. Well, you talked about, you know, preferring Classic Battletech over Alpha Strike a little bit, you know, kind of, you know, talk to me a little bit about kind of your gaming and what do you generally put on? Cause I've seen pictures. I, you know, your tabletop pictures are some of my favorite. Cause you got that amazing landscape. You got the painting skills to back it up. It looks really cool. So Classic Battletech, you know, in your own terrain, you know, how often do you get to game?
Fairly regularly. I'm very, very lucky in that my wife is incredibly accommodating and also a huge nerd. And she will listen to me when I'm like, okay, here we have members of the Tarian Concordat in this lance here, and they need to get across this field to secure these assets, but the evil mechs of House Lao are like, she'll be like, okay, yeah, sure. Absolutely. I believe you, honey. And she She learns the games, and to this day, we've been playing together for the better part of 10 years now, and I'm not sure if she pretends to be a little more clueless than she actually is. Yeah. And just has amazing beginner's luck that has lasted for 10 years. Or rather, I'm not sure which of these is true, because she lures me into a sense of complacency and then sometimes just completely punches me right in the face.
Excellent.
I've had games against her. We were playing a game of a game called Maelstrom's Edge, in which essentially what happened was I knew the game much better than she did. And I was kind of playing down. And then she read a part of the rule book I had never seen. And then half of my force had got napalm dropped on it. I'm like, I didn't know you could do that. Well, you should read the rule book better, honey. Like,
oh, that's perfect.
So she's actually fairly challenging, which I really appreciate. And she puts up with the fact that I like to play very fluffy games. I'm all about the story. I'm all about the lore. I enjoy a good crunchy competitive experience, certainly. But I like telling an interesting story more. And I think that's kind of why the scenery is so important to me.
I agree. Yeah.
I want it to look right. I want it to fire up my imagination. I don't want to have to just picture what it is that I'm doing. I want there to be the city that I'm fighting through. I want to feel the press of the urban sprawl. I like situations even where I can kind of forget that urban mech sort of disappeared into that alley, because I don't really see him until I look at him from a particular angle. Yeah. And then, oh, there he is. Oh God, I've wandered within three hexes of an AC-10. that's always a fun moment. But well,
I've yet to play with a game master that can kind of do true kind of, unknown, mechs hiding out there, not know until you walk in their line of sight. One of these days I'll get one, and then I can have a better game experience. I'm also kind of into the idea of doing, speed battle tech. Blaine calls it speed tech, but I'd also thought about the idea of just putting a time limit. Is you got 10 seconds, say where you want to go, point on the map. And if you happen to point farther than you can get, then you stop wherever, on your way there.
I like that
decide,
a lot.
I'm shooting this weapon there, you have to say it, real quick. Just in the moment.
Mistakes should be part of the game.
I agree.
In my opinion. And you overextend yourself. You don't consider something and you commit to something before you really understand the ramifications, mm-hmm. and you get punished for it.
Yeah.
As opposed to, because we've all gotten locked into those games of classic Battletech where it's like, okay, give me an hour to calculate literally every single move I could possibly make. Every ramification crazy. And then decide on the, no, it's it, do something.
Yeah. It's
pick a spot and go for it. Tell me broadly what it is you're trying to do. I'm much, much more into that. But at the same time, I appreciate the granularity of classic Battletech. It's this feeling. And it's essentially just that, to make it as simple as I can, bullets are dangerous. Anytime someone fires a bullet in anger at another person, there are countless possible ways that scenario can play out based on the context and what's going on. And that is not the feeling that you get from a lot of war games, where it's a very, very controlled, it'll pass through one or two quick rolls, and there's a very small number of things that could possibly happen. In Battletech, classic Battletech in particular, 3025 classic Battletech, to be very specific, I love knowing, and I know everybody's, oh, ammo explosions, stupid, man, ammo, I want case, plan invasion. I really kind of love knowing that anytime someone fires a weapon at me, any weapon at all, as long as the shot is technically possible, there is a combination of die rolls that can occur, which will result in me just exploding, or my pilot getting knocked out, or it gives me that feeling of like, anytime someone shoots anything at me, like I get a little tense, like what's going to happen. Oh, okay. It's just a bunch of armor. Okay. It's fine.
Yeah.
And, I like that. I like that a whole lot. It's that tension, that edgier seat feeling, and that sort of the Wild West gunslinger. My mech is held together by chewing gum and baling wire, and has been for the last 150 years, feeling of 3025 or fourth succession war Battletech. And then the Clanners show up and I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, I 95% of my gaming has all been 3025, mainly just because I don't have time to learn all the other stuff. You know, I know 3025, I enjoy it. You know, I haven't,
it gets very complicated very quickly.
It hasn't become boring for me yet. So I don't really need to go into beyond the clan, the early clan invasion. Once I get bored of doing the same thing over and over, then I'll move on. You know, I'll move to the next one. But I can't imagine, my brain isn't big enough to kind of, you know, understand and retain a knowledge of all the weapons available to 3150.
All the different all support the systems
available, and all the infantry and vehicles and VTOLs. It's just
different engines and different frames and different types of armor and 9 different variants of medium lasers. And oh my God. Yeah. I go cross-eyed after a while. I confess, I enjoy things like random assignment tables. And totally. Pre-existing damage rules, because I view BattleTech, I think a lot of people look at it in, and it's hard not to, we there's this environment of wargaming in the world, and there's the wargames that have become really popular like Warhammer 40K, and they have been constantly refining themselves into this very tight, competitive, crunchy experience. And I view BattleTech as having more DNA in common with like Advanced Dungeons and Dragons than it does with Warhammer 40K. Because you have this character sheet for your mech, and it has all these granular, precise stats, and you know where your servos and articulation points are, you know where your weapons are, you know where your ammo is, and you can tell someone can shoot a machine gun at you, and you can tell a story based on what happens from that. A bullet ricocheting around in the armor, hitting an ammo store, blowing off the right side of your mech. That big old thunderbolt that's been bullying everybody around the table all match, and then someone gets behind it with just a little medium laser, and they hit it in the ammo through the thin armor, and it splits open like a big endo steel banana. Like, these are the stories. These are the moments that I remember from BattleTech. The time that I run my Shadowhawk up to the midfield trying to be a bully to a couple of locusts, and one of them cracks open my fusion core, and I have to eject on the first round. So there's this untouched Shadowhawk, this pristine mech, just slumped over in the middle of the field because I pushed it too hard.
Very Duger-esque right there.
Yeah, very, very much so. Oh, I love that show.
Well, that's one of my questions I want to talk about later, because I know you're a big Duger-esque fan. But before we do, any house rules that you use on your classic BattleTech table?
So what you might notice with my terrain is that I, a long time ago, said, map scale, what's that? Mm-hmm. And I just kind of booted that right out. And if you look at my designs, I have this sort of, in my head, like sliding scale.
Okay.
Where everything is scaled to be in scale with the mechs. But if you were to take my buildings and port them into real life, you'd be like, that's oddly small. I make my thing, my terrain, and I make my buildings with playability in mind. So they have logical groupings of hexes, 3, 4, maybe as many as 8 hexes. I try to make interesting shapes out of them because I want them to be usable more than I want them to be precisely realistic.
Okay.
But in keeping with that, one of the other things you kind of have to do to make it seem plausible and to work, at least this is what I do, I house rule that I double all my ranges. Okay. And I'll double mech speeds as well. I'll just double speed, double range. It makes the games go faster. I know that's one of people's primary complaints about playing Intro Tech 3025 and Classic is we're just going to shoot back and forth at each other from 3 hexes away for the next 4 hours. So
yeah.
There are little changes that can be made to improve that. I like to run machine guns with pulse laser rules, for instance, so that their rapid fire nature is made up for by the fact that they can kind of walk onto targets. I'll usually say that machine gun ammo doesn't explode, because that has always driven me a little bit crazy. Like, you hit a storm missile, okay, fine. You hit a bunch of bullets, probably not. Like, it's never felt right. And it admittedly makes the Thunderbolt much more fragile than it should be. And I love the thud, but it always feels bad when my MG ammo goes up. But I just, you know, modify the game to taste. And that's one of the things I like the most about Classic BattleTech is it's an a la carte gaming experience.
Of course.
The game can change entirely depending on who you're playing with, because it's designed to pick and choose which rules you really want to use or don't feel right. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I say it has more in common with AD&D than it does Warhammer 40K, because 40K Can you find different house rules? Absolutely. But are there also, there's this tendency towards, okay, but what's the accepted competitive rule set? What is that? And that doesn't exist in Battletech, as far as I know. Alpha Strike, kind of. But even then, lots of optional rules.
I think it's, you know, it reminds me of that scene in Pirates of the Caribbean with Captain Barbosa. And he's like, the pirate code is more of a guideline than a rule, you know, and that's
guidelines.
Like guidelines. And that's what Battletech is. The rule books are, you know, nobody at CGL cares. You know,
if you're not having fun, whatever you want, change it.
Yeah. It's, you know, you make your own rules and those are your guidelines, you know, to use as kind of a reference for those home rules.
And I strongly support anyone who wants to invent house rules to make the game take a little less time. Cause yeah, CBT between two lances can drag out to like 6 hours sometimes. So
BTech, you heard it here.
Yeah.
You got 10 seconds to decide where it's going to move and who it's going to shoot and what it's going to shoot.
I love that system. Love that system.
Do it. And if you shoot something that's out of your range,
get like a chess clock. That could be fun too.
Oh, exactly. I like it. Yep. Click it back and forth. Yeah. Alpha Strike. I just played Alpha Strike for the first time last month. I was doing a road trip down to Florida and back, and I happened to be driving through North Carolina around the time when Fortress was doing their Alpha Strike tournament, and so hopped on. And I'd kind of had like I'd always played Classic, kind of like Alpha Strike just seems kind of dumbed down, but I had a lot of fun with it. It was cool to like, you know, get there as tactical. It was definitely different. You know, I didn't like the fact that my prime mech could get focused down, you know, in a single turn, you know, where that would be very difficult to do in class Battletech. But it was also cool to get my miniatures on the table and be able to move around a lot, go through a lot of games, you know, go through four games in a day, which you know, you'd never do with Classic.
It definitely has its benefits. I think that Alpha Strike, as it exists now, is a perfectly functional game that is undercooked. It needs more time in the oven. It needs more focus. And if I could snap my fingers and make the IP holders do something, it would be to focus almost all of their energy on a new edition of Alpha Strike that gives the game more identity. Because for a universe with so much personality, with such deep lore, for units that have so much, so much personality individually in Classic, they all start to feel the same in Alpha Strike pretty quickly. And my real problem with Alpha Strike, it's not really a problem. I don't really bother complaining about things unless I either like them or want to like them. Yeah. So I put thought into it. And with Alpha Strike, it's like I try to think mechanically of anything that it does that another war game, a more popular, better balanced war game, doesn't do better. And there's almost nothing. Classic Battletech does many things that other games simply do not do. There is no real comparable experience to it. Alpha Strike is like a slimmed down version of your Warhammer 40K-esque individual unit battle game. You could make it more like a skirmish. You can make it more like a war game, but it's also not as balanced, not as polished. So it's like, unless you really love the setting mechanically, there's not much reason to stick with it. And I don't think that has to be the case. I think that with some effort, with a new addition of rules, with some real like army building rules, some faction construction, some mercenary unit construction rules, stuff like that, like it could be a great game, but it needs some people to focus on it. And Battletech exists in a weird zone all by itself in all of wargaming, where we have a rule set that's like 35 years old and hasn't actually been iterated in all that time. It's been changed. Things have been added, little tweaks here and there, but it's pretty much the same rule system. And then Alpha Strike is not that old, obviously. It has evolved from a number of previously existing game systems within Battletech that have all kind of gone out of fashion, but it's similarly like hasn't really been iterated. It's really been changed all that much. And I think the big trick there is that it has been... Battletech's like a cursed property. I don't really understand exactly why it's so popular. It has such a place in the collective imaginations of an entire generation, but it always seems, it's like Swamp Thing. Like everybody knows what Swamp Thing is. everybody knows that they made a bunch of Swamp Thing movies back in the day. Every single time they've tried to make numerous Swamp Thing movies, make a Swamp Thing show, reboot it, like there's a curse. Something happens. Some executive loses his mind and cancels it at the wrong moment, or an actress gets injured, or it's crazy the number of times that property has fallen on its face. And BattleTech seems to have a similar problem, because like it just one thing after another. None of the game systems, none of the big pushes have ever really caught on. I think this latest one by CGL is the biggest that I can remember.
Yeah.
Having new minis certainly helps, but like we all remember MechWarrior Dark Age. We all have mixed feelings on MechWarrior Dark Age. I thought it was fantastic. And it did enough things wrong at the wrong time that it just never found the toehold that it needed to grow. Bad choices in distribution, a couple of poor sculpts that got a lot of publicity, older players who were just kind of uncomfortable with the newer system. Like it's this perfect storm of just not quite there. And I don't know why it's been so not quite fatal, but why it's kept BattleTech sort of in the back of the room for as long as it has, when we all love it so much. When other games have had their own hiccups, 40K has had some terrible additions, but it's never stopped being at the forefront of everyone's minds. Yeah. It's, you know, if I knew the reason for it, I'd probably be a wealthier man right now. But I'm really just so, so happy to see it finally getting some of the attention that it's deserved for so, so long. And I'm really hoping that that translates into more money, and more money translates into more developing time, bigger development teams, and that translates into new rules. Please. We need to join the modern pantheon of wargaming.
Keep having the passion of the fans push it. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I mean, it's, you know, people have to buy the product to fund the business, and the business has to be willing to, you know, innovate, you know, I think is the big thing.
Well, that's something that I wanted to mention also when I was talking about 3D printing. I 3D print almost everything that I use. And as part of that, I also go out of my way to purchase official product periodically, even if I don't always use it. I think it's important for people to bear in mind that you're not just buying pieces of plastic. You're not. You are buying into a living game system. And if you stop giving them money, the rules stop coming. The lore stops coming. The writers stop writing. You can't view it as just buying plastic. Yeah. You are supporting a living entity. And if you value that entity, give it some money every now and then. Mm-hmm. Or it's not going to be there.
For sure. Yeah, unfortunately, it's easy now. The minis look great. You know, so the product is good.
It's much easier now than it has been in the past.
For sure.
I've had experiences in the last 10 years where I told people about BattleTech and I described the Fourth Succession War, and they went, "That's amazing." I said, "Come down to the local game shop and I'll set up some, I got my Iron Wind Metals figures. We'll play. It'll be great. I got some plastic figures too." And I get there and I set it up and they come in and they look at it and they go, maybe we could play something else. I'm like, ah, shit.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. some of them have been pretty rough.
Well, let's talk Doogrim, because that's, you know, I enjoy the designs. I'm familiar with it, but I haven't kind of dove in. And I know that's a big love of yours, you know, and you've done a lot to, you know, print up a lot of those old sculpts. And so, yeah, tell me sell Doogrim to kind of the novice BattleTech fan that doesn't necessarily know where a lot of these original designs came from.
So when your average BattleTech fan starts thinking about the anime roots of BattleTech, the first thing a lot of them are going to think of is Macross, which or Robotech, as it's known, which is a great show. Mm-hmm. It is. It is a great show in the context of mecha anime, but they're also going to think of a lot of things like Gundam. A lot of people these days wouldn't have watched the original Mobile Suit Gundam. They might have watched some of the later ones. Gundam Wing would have been a lot of our first introduction to like mecha anime. And if you get into the genre, you realize very quickly that it's silly. It's very silly. You're like, it's about big robots in space, though. And it's like, yeah, but half the time the robots are magical. And the like, the main character is the son of the guy who designed it, and his blood unlocks a special power in the robot or something. It's almost unwatchable. it makes more sense if you're versed in the culture of the type of anime that it is. If you watch other thing, like, I hate to say it, but you watch like magical girl anime, it's going to make a lot more sense because it's all, you know, these genre blending things. Particularly in mecha anime, you run into asinine tropes, thousands and thousands of enemies fighting one hero, and the hero just kind of waves his hand and they explode in huge groups. And it's like, yeah, this is cute and all, but I'm like into warfare. And this is more superhero fantasy. And a lot of the time it is. Fang of the Sun Dugrum is one of the most surprisingly grounded pieces of military fiction in the history of mecha anime. And it can be hard to get into because it was made in 1981. It was the visual designer. Every time I post pictures of the blockhead, the Wolverine, someone always is like, oh, it looks like a Zaku. Everyone knows the Zaku. Everybody loves the Zaku. It's a great looking mobile suit from Gundam. What they may not realize is because it's the same guy designed them like 2 years apart. 1979, he did Mobile Suit Gundam. 1981, he did Fang of the Sun Dugrum. It's like same dude designed all of these mobile suits. And the writer director is really what brought that one together for me, though, because what you won't find in Dugrum is the main combat armor they're called in that. He won't fight 30 enemies at a time. You'll have a very grounded setup for the episode that's like, we have to make it through this valley. This valley is full of mines. We need to use the combat armor to spot and destroy the mines so we can get through it. On the other end of the valley, the enemy has deployed two blockhead combat armors. They're dangerous because they're physically larger than us and have heavier weapons. But because of the environment that we're in, they move a little bit slower. Okay, there's the episode, go. Or we need to get through this pass. There is a hardened anti-combat armor rifle at the top. There is a bunker at the bottom. The infantry will assault this way. The Dugrum combat armor will flank from, like, it's so grounded and so pleasing for nerds like me who really get into detailed military fiction. It deals with logistics. It deals with politics. It deals with, in an interesting way, the loss of innocence. Yeah. In a way that I honestly didn't expect. And if you just start the show, there's two characters, Crin and Daisy, who you're going to be like, oh, God, they're just, oh, yeah, the child in the combat armor, and he's better than everybody, and, oh, the girl who loves him, and they're going to meet up halfway. But it's like that storyline goes in a direction you just would never expect, because the storyline ultimately is about how they think of one another when they're apart, and then they come together and they realize that war has changed them into profoundly different people. And it's strangely touching, and it has an ending on it. It's a 75 episode run. It is all available on YouTube. I really advise people go watch it. The ending of it is so bittersweet, and they kind of tell you that it's coming in the first episode before you get to it, because the show opens with that shot I'm sure everyone has seen. I've made a model of it, which is the Dugrum mech, the combat armor, slumped over, sitting on its butt with its feet kind of splayed in front of it, one arm leaned over one of its elbows, and its head slumped forward, like obviously battered, broken, bruised, and abandoned in the desert, blasted by sand and just utterly derelict. The show opens with that, and then a character stumbles upon it in the desert, and then they remember. They're like, oh, that's right, we fought this rebellion. How did it come to this? And that's where the show kind of starts. And it's, I'm gonna put it this way. You could take the plot of Fang of the Sun Dugrum and you could set it in the periphery of Battletech post Fourth Succession War, change a couple names around, change nothing else. That's it. It would just fit. And it's kind of why those are some of my favorite stories and settings in 3025. I know a lot of people get really into the grand political schemes of Battletech. Being totally honest, I could not possibly care any less about what the House Davion is up to, what House Steiner is up to, what Operation Bulldog. I'm like, let's talk about this crappy little periphery world, this little agricultural community that's beset by pirates in barely functioning battle mechs, and the rinky dink little mercenary company with a 250-year-old spider that's going to fight them. Like, this is where that universe lives for me. And the story of Dugrum is very much like that. It's very narrow. It's very contained. The hero mech in it, the Dugrum, he doesn't have any special powers. He's not even necessarily better than any of the other combat armors, with the notable exception of the fact that the planet Deloyer lay within what they call the X Nebula, which just has a deleterious effect on like sensors and communication systems and reaction times within computers. And the Dugrum is shielded against that. That's the only advantage that it has, is that it reacts slightly faster than all the other combat armors do. And that goes away halfway into the series. The enemy shields their combat armors as part of the arms race subplot. And then the Dugrum's just like, well, I guess I'm average now. It's an incredibly pleasing story. And if you care about things like the real world, because okay, mechs are, let's just get this out of the way. Mechs are stupid. They make no sense at all. Like if we say in the real world, when is the military going to build mechs? The answer is never, because it's a terrible idea on every conceivable level. But they're so cool. And I still, even recognizing that they make no sense, I want them to be plausible. I want the writers to care enough about what they're doing that I can feel myself in that world, that I can imagine what it would be like to be next to one, to see one fighting, to be in one. They're this amazing analog for the modern soldier in a world where, you know, long distance missiles and tanks rule the battlefield. That's, I don't know, massive oversimplification, but you get my point. It's this analog for the soldier standing alone. It's the horse under the knight. It's that force multiplier. It's this heroic figure standing astride the field of battle like a god of war, making his presence known. And it just fires my imagination up so, so much. And I don't know how quite I got to that from talking about Dugrum. I guess just because that's what it makes me feel like when I watch it.
Awesome. I love it. That's great, great, great sell. I had posted that I was going to try to watch through the series earlier this year. I got through the first two episodes before life kind of distracted that goal, but I got to dive in. I got to get through those initial ones and get into the story.
You have to be willing to sift through some silliness.
Yeah.
You do. It is an older anime. It is dated. But if you're willing to put in the time, it's so, so rewarding in the later storylines. And it definitely suffers from that, like, you know, two people standing in a room having a conversation. Most of the frames are still and their mouths move, you know, but they knew where to spend their money. Cause then later in the same episode, it's like, okay, here's the part where the Dugrum is going to rip the upper half off of a tank. Nice. And it's like, they animate the fingers going into the metal and the rivets breaking as it peels the turret off. And you're like, oh yeah, they knew what they wanted to spend their money on.
Excellent. Well, it was cool what you were talking about, how it's plausible Dugrum could be set in the inner sphere, because I've thought about that too, you know, just even from my limited exposure, it seems like a setting that you could say this happened on this planet out there away from the grand politics, you know, where there's, you know, there's no giant assault mechs walking around, you know, you got, you know, you're kind of scrappy mediums and doing their thing.
There's a couple of battle masters toward the end.
Yeah. Yep.
It's about it.
As it should be. They should be rare, you know, which is, I think the fan base loves their heavies and assaults. And I'm just like, let's fight with mediums. That's what we should be fighting. Mediums and lights
and mediums, man. That's where I live.
Definitely. Things go faster too. We were talking about kind of the movement and mech practicality. I always bring this up because I love talking about this, but you know, in your head, how do mechs move in Battletech? Is it MechWarrior Online tank? Is it Dugrum, or is it somewhere in between?
Dugrum definitely colors how I think about it. Yeah. I like my mechs to be fluid and remarkably human in their movements. I'm not a huge fan of the direction that, because I mean, you know, MechWarrior, when it came into being, when they started making those games, it was working in there's me writing down in a book, and then because of the influence of the Neuro helmets, the pilot was able to feel how unbalanced the mech was and shift his weight onto his back heel and throw a punch and twist his. And I'm like, okay, now how do I do that with a mouse and keyboard?
Yeah.
And the answer is you don't, because that's crazy. We don't. Everything that I want mechs to do is rendered possible by the hand wavium magic of the Neuro helmet for the most part.
Yeah.
So in MechWarrior, things necessarily became more stompy, shooty, and arcadey.
Yeah.
And that's great. Those games are fantastic. But in a weird way, because that's been one of the most popular the most popular windows that people have had into the BattleTech universe. That's sort of dominated how they think of battle mechs. Yeah. And I am personally not a fan of it. I don't like the stomping rectangles of MechWarrior Online. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, spiders and commandos that are nimble, quick little machines that move like a person. And they move that way, again, because your brain is literally wired into this machine. So you're able to think like, oh, I want to move my hand and have the machine echo that movement using its mimer. Mm-hmm. In my head, I've kind of headcanoned a lot of the less humanoid designs from the clans in the later eras as, well, when the Star League was, you know, ascendant, when the Star League was at its peak, when it was this grand empire. It was easy at that moment when you're building these incredible machines to go, well, we want this to represent just how awesome we are. We can afford to give our mechs hands and have them be like soldiers standing on the field. We can afford to have them pick up their weapons and move like people. And then later on, as things become more desperate, it's more like, well, what I really need are a bunch of lasers with legs. And so maybe that's more what you're going to build. And so these things can simultaneously exist. But my favorite is always going to be, I mean, the Shadowhawk is pretty much my favorite mech. And yeah. It's one of the most maligned mechs in the setting because the 2H is kind of garbage. it is garbage because of the way that it was designed in Dugrum and because some writers back in the day were like, look at the random weapon systems it has on it. How do we make sense of those within our rules? And unfortunately, that resulted in being a jack of all trades and a master of none, though calling it even a jack of all trades is probably being too generous. So yeah, okay, go up to like the 2K or something, put a PPC on its shoulder, give it a couple more medium lasers, and it becomes more functional, fair enough. But the design of it is something that I truly love. That it doesn't look like a person necessarily. It doesn't have like the Atlas or the Commando feeling where it has like a human head on it. It's very distinctly a machine. Mm-hmm. But the way that it's configured is based on the human frame. And if you're going to build something like a person, if you're going to give it bilateral symmetry, you're going to build it with our general proportions, it should move like us.
Yeah.
Because we don't walk the way we do. We don't swing our arms when we walk because it's fun. We don't do it because it's a cultural affectation. We do it because that's how this machine works. That's how these two legs are designed to move while also balancing a torso on top of them. So I like that more naturalistic, smooth, and also I love melee combat in BattleTech, which is something that rarely, if ever, makes it into MechWarrior.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll just go ahead and say right now, Pacific Rim for life. Love that movie.
Rocket-powered punches.
Oh my God. The big robots punching things is the pinnacle of my being. Yes, very, very much so. I'm a big fan of the Charger as a result. Yeah, the original okay. Charger with its like five small lasers. I think that thing's freaking hilarious.
Awesome.
And that it's written into the story as this was a boondoggle that nobody wanted. But then numerous nuclear wars happened. Someone found a warehouse full of them. And suddenly they were like, it's huge and it's got two legs and a gyro. Let's do it.
It's better than my rifle, you know. So yeah.
We can't build the nice ones anymore. So these ones kick ass. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
Yeah. Well, I'm totally on that page. I mean, I agree. I think that because, and I talked about this a little bit with Alex, I think Alex Iglesias, when I had him on, about kind of how MechWarrior has kind of skewed the perception of what a mech is because it was limited to what you could put on a gaming platform, on the computer, how you can make things move. You can't have a game like MechWarrior and have a Gundam type of mech motion. You've got to make it blocky. You got to make it easy to program practically.
It has to work first.
And then unfortunately that kind of got pulled back into the main setting. And then the main setting started to replicate that these are, you know, walking tanks where, you know, they're not walking tanks. Unfortunately, when I did my last round table with Stackpole and Blaine, that I asked them, I was like, how do mechs move for you? And it was like, it tickled me to hear, you know, I think it was Stackpole that took the question. It's like, yeah, these things, there's a reason they're humanoid. There's a reason they have, you know, mimers that move like muscles. You know, they're not walking tanks.
I like Stackpole's view on the whole universe, honestly. Yeah. He has the imagination required to go, fusion reactors explode. And then nerd comes in and goes, well, actually, that's not what, and he's like, shut up. It explodes.
Yep.
It's fucking awesome. Pardon.
No.
I really respect that.
Totally. Yeah, that was a fun conversation. It was fun to hear. You know, and I'm a huge fan of Bruins' animations, you know, and the way Mechs move in there, and we've talked about it, you know, on our various casts. But you know, and we'll be getting more from Bruins, you know, in the coming year, you know, between techs and, you know, hopefully get a project or two going through Renegade HPG, so we can see Mechs moving more like they should, according to Chris and Travis.
They're even described in some of the latest novels that they've done. In just the little like pamphlet novel they include in the current starter set, I think it's called like Eye Storm, which, by the way, they have a setting in that book where they're on a planet that has, I think, is it solar? It's like locked relative to its sun. So one side is always day and one side's always night. And then in the area between, there's like these crazy storms or something like that. It's a really hostile planet. I found it really interesting, and I'd love to make some stuff based on that. But like they describe at one moment a commando mech running in and then skidding to a stop on one of its knees, reaching down with its hand and scooping a pilot up off the ground and then holding it very gingerly while it runs. And I'm like, yes, this.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Why do we have hands if we can't do these things?
Yeah. I totally think. I have a couple ideas. I want to get them visualized. Or talk to Bruins. I'm going to try to get some cool stuff into video this next year, but we'll enjoy that. We'll explore that a little. I'm definitely exploring that with Gallery 3025, and you know, we've been a little, it's been a little quiet in there lately, but it's more just kind of getting the right people in place to get some professional concept artists to kind of try their hand at BattleTech and get some cooler scenes, you know, and particularly.
It takes time to do it right.
It does. It does. You know, we're not just doing kind of like little sketches here and there, but, you know, I think a big thing is, showing more of that kind of the versatility of a mech, you know, and what you can do with a mech, you know, in that art, you know, and, so that's going to be a theme. And elementals, we're going to explore elementals a little bit more.
Yeah. Everybody loves power armor. Yeah. Well, and I would honestly also mention that style of movement, that's part of how, as a child, I answered the question when I realized that, like, you asked the question, why do I want a mech? Tanks do everything that mechs do, but cheaper and better for the most part. There isn't really much of a reason to want it to stand up on two legs and run around. So in my head, I'm thinking like, well, okay, what a tank can't do is see someone firing at it and then with the speed of thought react by twisting out of the way, shifting its weight onto one leg. A tank can't be flying through the air and adjust itself and its body weight to land in a particular way as it comes. I'm like, these are that type of movement, that precision and that thought connection. Like, this is why you would want to have a battle mech. It's so much more agile, so much more reactive. If it's not going to be more agile and reactive, you're probably just going to put it on treads.
Yeah. Or even hiding behind cover. Hide behind an awesome cityscape on your tabletop. Or, you know, hide behind a hill, pop out, shoot, come back in. You know, tank can't do that. A mech can. You know, those are it's the nimbleness of that. That's what justifies why you upgrade it to mechs. Because mechs, you know, if they're doing what they're supposed to with Myomers, with essentially a full musculature, they move not like a gymnast, but you know, they move like
a big soldier, though.
A relatively athletic but large individual, you know.
Yeah. Adjusted to scale, of course. It would be like watching someone move around very sluggishly.
Yeah. I would say it's like, you know, a light mech is kind of like an Olympic sprinter, you know, a medium mech is kind of maybe like a running back, you know, a heavy mech is maybe like a lineman, and like an assault mech is like a sumo wrestler, you know.
Yeah,
all those
wearing a big old backpack while he's at it.
Yeah, all those athletes can do some really amazing things for their size, but you know, they're not lumbering tanks, you know. They can do some. Well, cool. Well, this has been fun, Chris. I'm gonna let you go. It's late.
Oh yeah, no, this is. I mean, thank you for having me. I hope that I've been mildly informative or at least interesting.
No, I've had a ton of fun talking. You know, I really enjoy, you know, watching your Twitch streams. I think you've got a great banter, and I appreciate it. It's fun. It's fun to watch. You know, it's fun to watch you paint. You know, we didn't even talk too much about painting. Maybe I'll get you back on. I've been kind of, you know, brainstorming the idea of getting two or three painters into a round table. And for me as a novice, and maybe get one or two other novices, and just kind of like ask questions and like, you know, pick the brains of all the
very open to that. That sounds like fun, honestly.
Cool. Yeah. I think
I love talking about painting. And like you said, we haven't really today. It's a whole other can of worms.
Excellent.
And that, you know, crosses from BattleTech into the numerous other game systems that I play, which is frankly too many. I'm glad that you enjoy the stream. I would note to anybody who's interested, we do stream 3 days a week. I'm on Twitch Sunday nights, Tuesday nights, and Thursday nights starting at 5 p.m. Mountain Time. And if you're curious at all about anything that I do, we do a lot of BattleTech. We do a lot of fantasy miniatures. We do other sci-fi minis. I play Warcaster. I do Star Wars stuff. And I'm always willing to talk about pretty much anything you want. So feel free to stop in, ask some questions.
Excellent. And I also found you on YouTube today. So you got a lot of videos that are archived there. So people can find you at Thunderhead Studio on YouTube.
I need
what
to do
are other
more
platforms?
With that.
What are, you know, definitely on Facebook. So find you on Facebook. Are you on Instagram, Twitter?
I'm on Facebook, Instagram primarily. I have a Twitter presence. It's not much of one. It's mostly just me announcing when I go live on Twitch. I do have YouTube. It is pretty much just an archive of my streams. I don't really edit them or do anything with that. I intend to turn the YouTube channel into something more deliberate over the course of the next 6 months to a year. But for now, it's pretty much just an archive.
Well, I highly recommend that for people that are out there looking for... looking to learn about painting, you know, and enjoy some fun, nerdy discussion along the way. It's, you know, they're archived there, and YouTube's not very good at recommending new stuff, but Twitch is not great for finding old videos. I remember even when I was following your stuff and learning how to paint myself, there were streams that I saw you going live with that I couldn't watch at the time. And then I had trouble finding them 2 days later, three days later. So, but YouTube, you won't have the problem. They're all there. Nice, easy to find archive.
I grouped them by what I was painting that day too. So if it's BattleTech specifically you want to see, you can click on BattleTech streams and just look at that.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Chris. You know, everyone else, find Chris on Thunderhead Studio and all those platforms. And we'll get Chris back here for a painting roundtable. I'll try to get some. I'll get a few people, a few veterans, and a few novices to kind of ask questions and answer them. And we'll make that.
I look forward to it.
Sounds good. Thanks again, Chris. Good night. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.